General Electric once stood as the pinnacle of American business achievement, the world's most valuable and admired company, a beacon of innovation and management excellence. Yet within two decades, this corporate colossus would collapse under the weight of mismanagement, hubris, and financial engineering gone wrong. The story of GE's meteoric rise and spectacular fall offers a cautionary tale about corporate leadership that transcends business circles. When Jack Welch handed the reins to Jeff Immelt in 2001, GE was worth nearly $600 billion. By 2020, its value had plummeted by over 80%, erasing hundreds of billions in shareholder wealth. This dramatic reversal of fortune has become required reading in business schools worldwide, with legendary investor Warren Buffett calling GE's decline a classic example of the difficulty of evaluating what looks easy. The company that brought electricity to America and pioneered everything from light bulbs to jet engines ultimately couldn't illuminate its own path to sustainable success. The merger that created General Electric in 1892 was the culmination of years of negotiations between Thomas Edison's Edison General Electric Company and its chief rival, Thomson Houston Electric Company. Edison himself was initially resistant to the deal, turning as white as his collar when informed of the merger talks. The financial backers behind both companies saw tremendous advantages in combining forces, citing greater economy of management and pooled technical expertise as key benefits. The structure of the merger revealed the power dynamics at play. Thomson Houston shareholders received 5 shares of the new General Electric for every 3 shares they held, while Edison General shareholders received just 1 for 1, reflecting Thomson Houston's superior profitability. This left Edison with less than 10% ownership in the company bearing his name, a common fate for founders with capital-intensive businesses in an era before dual-class stock structures could protect their interests. Edison publicly spun the merger as financially advantageous, while privately fuming at being outmaneuvered. He blamed both Henry Villard, the financier behind Edison General, and his former secretary Samuel Insull for the situation. In a final act of defiance, Edison sold his entire stake in 1893 for $1.5 million, declaring electricity old and beneath his continued attention as he moved on to new ventures. The newly formed General Electric immediately faced an existential threat with the devastating panic of 1893. Orders plummeted 75%, 2/3 of workers were dismissed, and the company struggled with $10 million in debt while customers couldn't pay their bills. With bankruptcy looming, CEO Charles Coffin devised a plan to sell company-owned securities at substantial losses to raise cash. After securing J.P. Morgan's crucial approval, the cash infusion saved the company. This brush with disaster permanently changed Coffin, who became obsessed with financial conservatism. He instituted the accounting principle, use cost or market value, whichever is the lower, a philosophy that would guide GE for decades. The company curtailed customer credit and accepted lower profits, operating with a negative surplus for 15 years thereafter. This early crisis established GE's reputation for financial discipline that would later become a cornerstone of its success. World War I transformed GE from a mere business into a crucial component of America's military-industrial complex. The company's executives became integral to the war effort, with research director W.R. Whitney serving on the Naval Consulting Board. GE rapidly developed military technologies, including lightweight searchlights for spotting bombers, submarine detectors, specialized motors, and bomb release mechanisms. Under the leadership of Owen D. Young, GE strategically entered the radio business following the war. Young, who had risen from humble farming roots to become GE's general counsel, navigated complex negotiations with American Marconi to create Radio Corporation of America, RCA, as a GE subsidiary. This move unleashed American technological innovation in radio and television broadcasting, dramatically reducing transatlantic communication costs and eventually reaching 40 million Americans by 1928. Young's pragmatic leadership was evident when, following antitrust action in 1932, GE was forced to spin off RCA to shareholders. Rather than fight the government, Young recognized the need to adapt to changing regulatory environments, a lesson future GE leaders would both embrace and ignore at different points in the company's history. The radio business demonstrated GE's ability to identify emerging technologies and leverage them into new business opportunities. This pattern of technological innovation, combined with strategic acquisitions, would become a hallmark of GE's growth strategy throughout the 20th century, allowing the company to continuously reinvent itself as markets evolved. By the 1950s, GE had evolved into a manufacturing powerhouse, producing 200,000 different products across 170 plants in 31 states and multiple countries. The company employed 250,000 people, maintained research laboratories with 20,000 scientists and engineers, and generated over $150 million in net income on more than $3 billion in revenue. Ralph Kordner, who became CEO in 1951, immediately implemented a radical decentralization plan that would fundamentally reshape how GE operated. He split the company into 27 independent divisions comprising 110 small companies, each for one man to get his arms around. Division leaders gained unprecedented autonomy to make day-to-day decisions, propose budgets, and approve capital expenditures up to $200,000. Kordner bluntly told Time magazine, "When I took over in 1951, I told lots of people immediately that this company was not going to be a sinecure for mediocrity." He eliminated assistants, coordinators, and committees, declaring that committees move at the speed of the least informed member and too often are used as a way of sharing irresponsibility. This reorganization, one of the largest in corporate history, faced immediate resistance. Kordner shifted 2,000 managers to new assignments across the country, disrupting families and careers. Executives accustomed to giving orders were told to step back, serving only as consultants to newly empowered operating executives. The decentralization created a culture where price fixing thrived, however. The conspiracy operated with elaborate secrecy. Executives used code names, maintained Christmas card lists of conspirators, and held choir practice meetings in hotel rooms. Each company had a number. GE was one, and participants used only first names. The cartel and circuit breakers allocated market share precisely. GE 45%, Westinghouse 35%, Alice Chalmers 10%, and Federal Pacific 10%. What drove this behavior was both industry volatility and Kordner's relentless pressure for results. As one executive explained, "Each year we had to budget for more profit as a percent of net sales, creating a situation where managers felt we couldn't accomplish a greater percent of net profit without getting together with competitors." The conspiracy was eventually exposed in 1959, leading to criminal charges and a significant blow to GE's reputation. Jack Welch joined GE in 1960, just as the price-fixing scandal was unfolding. After discovering his $1,000 raise matched everyone else's despite his superior performance, Jack went apeshit and quit to take a job elsewhere. However, Reuben Goodoff, impressed by Jack's presentation about plastic pellets, convinced him to stay with a $4,000 raise and freedom from his former boss. "All of a sudden, I had a rabbi," Jack said of Goodoff. "This guy loved me. He was a slick operator. I learned from him." For the next 17 years, Jack ran GE's Pittsfield operation like his personal fiefdom, complete with his own private jet and office space in a downtown Hilton. His early career survived potential disasters, including when the PPO factory literally exploded in 1963. Though responsible for the incident, Jack was spared by Charlie Reed, a fellow chemical engineer who took a clinical rather than emotional approach to the failure. Jack's ambition drove the development of Noral, a modified version of PPO created after discovering the original formula became brittle at high temperatures. Under his leadership, Lexan became a wildly successful product that was clear as glass and tough as steel. Jack marketed it aggressively, hiring baseball stars Bob Gibson and Denny McClain to demonstrate its durability. Following the deaths of both parents in the mid-1960s, Jack threw himself into both work and play. He and his band of Indians engaged in frequent parties at local bars and behavior that wasn't the norm, all while his wife Carolyn remained home caring for their four children. Jack's wild behavior included insulting colleagues, goosing a colleague's wife at a dinner party, and frequenting local bars with his Jack Pack. Despite this behavior, which faced no accountability in the pre-internet, pre-Me Too era, Jack's career continued its upward trajectory. By March 1972, at just 36, he became a GE vice president, earning his first mention in the New York Times and building what amounted to an entire shadow GE through his ambition and energy. When Reginald "Reg" Jones announced his retirement as GE CEO in 1980, Jack Welch found himself competing against five other executives for the top job: Robert Frederick from corporate planning, Stanley Galt from industrial products, Tom Vanderslice from power systems, Ed Hood from technical products, and John Burlingame from the international division. Jack hated the daily competition, feeling he was walking on eggshells and watching colleagues kissing ass. Without his mentors Gutoff, who had left, and Weiss, who had died, Jack felt isolated in the unfamiliar corporate environment. In June 1980, Jones asked Jack to write a memorandum explaining why he deserved to be CEO. Jack's 8-page letter was characteristically self-deprecating, charming, ambitious, and serious. He highlighted his leadership capabilities, noting that people working with him have worked harder, enjoyed it more, although not always initially, and in the end, gain increased self-respect from accomplishing more than they previously thought possible. After submitting his memo, Jack began receiving positive signals about his candidacy. At a summer party, he cornered HR partner Dave Orsolet, who reluctantly revealed enough to make Jack optimistic. In September 1980, board member Ed Littlefield invited Jack to be his golf partner at the exclusive Cypress Point tournament, where Jack hit his first hole-in-one in 30 years. On December 15th, Jones officially informed Jack he would become CEO, with Hood and Burlingame staying on as vice chairman. At the announcement press conference, Jack declared himself the most happy man in America today. Years later, Jack estimated the reaction was split. 40% cheered, 20% didn't know, and 40% died. Hated the fucking thing. Hated the idea that Jack Welch had won. The transition wasn't entirely smooth. At a February party Jones threw for Jack at the Helmsley Palace Hotel, Jack enjoyed himself thoroughly, having a few extra vodkas and socializing enthusiastically. The next morning, Jones angrily accused Jack of embarrassing him and the company. Jack was devastated until Jones returned hours later to apologize, having received over 20 calls from guests praising the event. "That's who I am," Jack told Jones, who admitted, "I never saw that. They all saw it, but I never saw it." Jack wasted no time transforming GE. One early target was the Elfin Society, an organization of GE executives he considered an organization of suck-ups representing superficial congeniality. At their annual leadership conference, Jack bluntly told them, "I can't find any value to what you're doing. You're a hierarchical, social, and political club." Within weeks, Jack had transformed Elfun into a community volunteer organization of 42,000 members focused on building parks, playgrounds, and libraries. Jack made his Wall Street debut at the Pierre Hotel, presenting to research analysts without mentioning a single earnings number. Instead, he summarized Carl von Clausewitz's military theories, arguing that in the slow-growth 1980s, companies must insist upon being number one or number two in every business or exit them. He posed Peter Drucker's famous question, "If you weren't already in the business, would you enter it today?" The analysts were unimpressed. GE stock rose just 12 cents after his presentation. In January 1983, Jack sketched his vision for GE on a restaurant napkin, drawing three interlocking circles representing GE's focus areas: core businesses, major appliances, lighting, turbines, transportation, motors; high technology businesses, medical, aerospace, aircraft engines, materials, industrial electronics; and services businesses, financial, information, construction and engineering, nuclear. Any business outside these circles, Jack decided to fix, sell, or close. Jack was determined to slim down GE's bureaucracy, firing 40,000 employees in his first 9 months and another 60,000 during his first 2 years. The media nicknamed him Neutron Jack. Like the neutron bomb, he eliminated people but left buildings standing. Bob Nelson, his head of human relations, thought the nickname was accurate. At Appliance Park in Louisville, Jack cut the workforce in half while keeping the six big factories. Jack's factory visit struck fear in local managers. Rumors spread that fat people were told to stay out of sight, and one plant manager even kept a list of deceased employees to show progress in job reductions. Ironically, Jack's cuts nearly destroyed the economy of his beloved Pittsfield, where 80% of GE's workforce disappeared, with similar decimation in Schenectady and Waterford. By the mid-1980s, Wall Street dealmaking had captured America's imagination, becoming the subject of films like Oliver Stone's Wall Street and Tom Wolfe's novel The Bonfire of the Vanities. Investment bankers achieved celebrity status in wealthy communities, and Jack Welch was not immune to the magnetic pull of financial dealmaking. Jack desperately wanted a television network, seeing it as a business foreigners couldn't own due to regulations, protection from the Japanese competitors he feared in manufacturing. After an unrequited interest in CBS and Capital Cities Communications buying ABC, Jack set his sights on RCA, which owned NBC. Ironically, GE had been forced by the Justice Department to divest RCA back in 1933, and a recently eliminated consent decree now made repurchasing possible. The RCA board voted 9-1 to pursue a deal with GE, with Frederick being the lone dissenter. Jack offered $66.50 per share in cash, deliberately 50 cents more than expected, to leave goodwill when the seller's ongoing involvement was important to the company's success. The $6.3 billion acquisition, the largest non-oil merger in history, took just 36 days from first meeting to announcement, cementing Jack's reputation as a savvy dealmaker. Jack methodically dismantled the pieces of RCA that didn't fit his best-in-class vision for GE. He sold RCA records to Bertelsmann, TVs to Thompson, radio to Westwood One, and spun off the carpet business. The David Sarnoff Research Center was given to SRI International with $250 million in contracts. These sales generated around $1.3 billion plus another $1 billion from the Thompson deal. Jack's deal with Thompson was particularly brilliant. While entertaining customers at the French Open, he met with Thompson chairman Alain Gomez and proposed swapping GE's TV manufacturing business for Thompson's medical imaging business, CGR. Though Gomez initially resisted selling CGR, he was enticed by the opportunity to become the world's largest TV manufacturer. Thompson paid GE $1 billion in cash and transferred valuable patents, generating $100 million in annual after-tax profits for 15 years. The deal tripled GE's market share of medical equipment in Europe to 15%. When Grant Tinker declined to stay as NBC's leader, despite Jack offering an ocean of money, Jack appointed his friend Bob Wright to run the network. Despite industry skepticism about how this GE guy could run a network, Jack was determined to streamline operations. In a closed-door session with NBC executives in 1987, Jack praised the network's accomplishments but warned that some turkeys would soon be looking for work. While Jack Welch was transforming GE's industrial businesses, he recognized the untapped potential in GE Credit, later GE Capital. Despite his limited financial background, Jack's instinct told him the business could be transformative. Originally focused on financing GE appliance purchases, the unit had expanded into equipment leasing, second mortgages, commercial real estate, manufactured homes, and private label credit cards. Jack was impressed that GE Credit generated per-person profit of around $9,500 in 1977, compared to just $2,100 in his plastics business. "To play with money was so much better than bending metal," Jack observed. Under his leadership, GE Credit pioneered what later became known as the high-yield or junk bond market, profitably lending to less creditworthy customers. By 2000, the renamed GE Capital grew from $67 million in earnings with 7,000 employees to $5.2 billion with 89,000 employees. The success hinged on GE's AAA credit rating, allowing it to borrow money more cheaply than banks, and using GE Capital to reduce taxes on industrial earnings through strategic depreciation arrangements. GE Capital expanded into buying accounts receivable, financing leveraged buyouts, manufactured homes, real estate purchases, and more, all under an 8-to-1 leverage ratio presented to Wall Street as one big business without transparency into individual segments. By the end of the 1980s, GE Capital had transformed from a $115 million profit center to a financial powerhouse generating nearly $1 billion in profit, contributing 20.7% of GE's net income. This shift toward financial services drew scrutiny from financial analysts. In October 1990, money manager David Tice published a critical analysis in Barron's questioning Jack's expansion into financial services. After his article, GE's stock fell 3% on Monday morning, eventually dropping 9% in 1 week and 27% from its July high. GE went on the offensive with investor conference calls where Larry Bossidy defended GE Capital's practices, claiming earnings grew 20% in the first half of 1990, with projected 15-20% growth in the second half. Inside GE, the problems in the LBO group were significant enough that managers warned junior employees to be cautious in meetings with Jack. During one skip-level meeting, Jack directly confronted an employee about troubled assets, demonstrating he already knew about the problematic companies at GE Capital. Jack bluntly told the group, "If we blow up GE Capital right now, our PE is going to go from 11 to 2, and there's nothing in the world I could ever do as CEO that would ever compensate for that." As Jack Welch approached retirement, the question of succession loomed large. Unlike his predecessor, Red Jones, who had put Jack through a public competition, Jack was determined to handle succession differently. By 1998, the field had narrowed to three finalists: Jeff Immelt, Medical Systems; Jim McNerney, Aircraft Engines; and Bob Nardelli, Power Systems. Jack deliberately kept them stationed away from headquarters to prevent them from trying to curry favor with him in Fairfield. The board's Management Development and Compensation Committee spent nearly 4 hours wrestling with the pros and cons of each candidate. Though Jack was fighting not to make up his mind prematurely, Cornell President Frank Rhodes suggested Immelt was the one, a choice Jack, Dennis Dammerman, and Bill Connedy agreed with, though they weren't ready to make it official. Despite the growing consensus around Immelt, board member Ken Langone revealed McNerney had been shopping around for jobs outside GE, effectively removing him from consideration. Langone believed Nardelli was never truly in contention, but merely a stalking horse, claiming Jack had already decided on Immelt and simply wanted to create this magnificent moment. The decisive board meeting took place October 29th in Greenville, South Carolina, home of GE's Power Systems business run by Nardelli. After a day of golf at Augusta National, the board convened for dinner at the exclusive Poinsett Club. Bob Wright, NBC CEO and newly appointed GE vice chairman, recalled Jack seemed uncommonly nervous as he initiated an informal succession discussion. When Jack asked Wright for his recommendation, Wright supported Immelt, though he later admitted he personally preferred McNerney but had promised Jack his support. Though Jack portrayed the decision as unanimous, Langone revealed that Paolo Fresco objected to Immelt's selection, arguing emphatically for McNerney. Dennis Naden at GE Capital agreed with Fresco, believing McNerney was superior hands down as a leader. Naden criticized Immelt as lacking people skills, contrasting him with Jack, who, despite being opinionated, would listen to others and could be persuaded to change his mind. Jack faced the difficult task of telling McNerney and Nardelli they hadn't been selected. On a stormy Sunday, he flew first to Cincinnati to meet McNerney, who joked about wanting a recount like the ongoing Florida election dispute. Though disappointed, McNerney remained gracious. Jack then flew to Albany to tell Nardelli, who took the news harder, asking, "What more could I have done?" Jack insisted both men would make excellent CEOs elsewhere. Though Jack portrayed the decision as unanimous, Langone revealed that Paolo Fresco objected to Immelt's selection, arguing emphatically for McNerney. Dennis Naden at GE Capital agreed with Fresco, believing McNerney was superior hands down as a leader. Naden criticized Immelt as lacking people skills, contrasting him with Jack, who, despite being opinionated, would listen to others and could be persuaded to change his mind. Jack faced the difficult task of telling McNerney and Nardelli they hadn't been selected. On a stormy Sunday, he flew first to Cincinnati to meet McNerney, who joked about wanting a recount like the ongoing Florida election dispute. Though disappointed, McNerney remained gracious. Jack then flew to Albany to tell Nardelli, who took the news harder, asking, "What more could I have done?" Jack insisted both men would make excellent CEOs elsewhere. When Jeff Immelt took over GE on September 10, 2001, the company was trading near $40 per share with a market value approaching $400 billion, ranked as both the most respected and most admired company globally. However, the days that followed would reveal a stark contrast between the popular perception of GE and its reality. The September 11 attacks immediately tested Immelt's leadership. With his executive team scattered across the country, he coordinated GE's response through teleconferences. The crisis demanded immediate action, as GE faced multiple challenges. Two employees killed, canceled NBC commercials costing hundreds of millions, reinsurance exposure to both towers and all four planes totaling a $1 billion write-off, and existential questions about GE's massive aviation business. When markets reopened on September 17th, GE stock immediately lost $40 billion in value, with another $50 billion vanishing 3 days later, a 25% decline on top of the one-third drop since August 2000. GE's stock liquidity made it an easy target for investors needing cash. Immelt was shocked when GE's largest shareholder dumped half its stake, claiming ignorance about GE's reinsurance exposure. This revealed a troubling reality. People didn't really know why they owned GE at that moment in time. Many GE observers believed Immelt should have used the post-9/11 period to reset Wall Street's expectations about GE's earnings. He could have ended Jack's practice of managing earnings, taken necessary write-downs, and diffused the ticking time bombs in GE's balance sheet. Jeffrey Sprague, a Wall Street analyst, noted, 9/11 was a terrible event, but it did provide an opening to reset things, and he really chose not to do it. Years later, Immelt admitted, "I wish I had reset the company in 2002. Following the collapses of Enron, WorldCom, and other major companies due to accounting scandals, media and investors grew increasingly skeptical about corporate disclosure practices. GE, with its remarkably consistent earnings record, became an obvious target. Even Fortune magazine, which had just named GE the most admired company for the fifth consecutive year, joined the skeptics. The financial precision once admired was now viewed with suspicion, with one analyst noting that companies delivering reliable 15% growth were the new smokers. Immelt defended GE's practices, insisting, "We don't manage earnings, we manage businesses." By mid-2007, warning signs emerged as GE's credit default swaps costs surged from 12 to 64 basis points, a fivefold increase. Despite this, Emmott relied on McKinsey's optimistic assessment that GE Capital would remain well-funded through sovereign wealth funds, overlooking the fundamental risk of operating an industrial company inside a bank. In April 2008, GE shocked markets by missing earnings projections by $700 million, causing its stock to plunge 13% in one day. Emmott finally acknowledged that GE Capital had long served as an earnings candy store, but the financial crisis made selling assets nearly impossible. This prompted Jack Welch to publicly criticize Emmott on CNBC, declaring he had a credibility crash. Emmott responded privately to Welch, confronting him about the difficult legacy he'd inherited. The 2008 Lehman Brothers collapse brought GE to the brink. Unable to become a bank holding company or access TARP, GE faced a crisis when initially excluded from the FDIC's Temporary Liquidity Guarantee Program. This exclusion effectively rendered GE's long-term debt worthless, as investors favored competitors with government guarantees. After intense lobbying and paying $2 billion in fees, GE Capital gained access to the program, ultimately issuing $131 billion in FDIC-guaranteed debt. Emmott later described the experience as like having the stomach flu for 18 months, though he managed to navigate the crisis without revealing its full severity. By 2015, after 14 years at the helm, Emmott believed he had finally turned the GE battleship in the right direction. GE Capital was being unwound, the CFI designation would soon disappear, and the Alstom deal had closed. Trion Partners' $2.5 billion investment seemed to validate Emmott's strategy. Despite challenges in oil and gas, Emmott projected confidence from the SNL stage he'd rented for his annual State of the Union. One hedge fund investor remarked, "A year ago, only 25% of the people in this room would have supported Jeff. Today, he is a god." However, GE's power business, particularly after the Alstom acquisition, was imploding. The company had miscalculated demand for the H turbine and maintained an optimistic market outlook while competitor Siemens correctly predicted a downturn. As pressure mounted to hit power's numbers, executives resorted to desperate measures. Paul Melhelini, who ran power's service business, pushed Joe Mastrangelo, head of new units, to build billions of dollars worth of upgrade kits, profitable turbine upgrades, without orders. Eventually, Mastrangelo relented and built the kits at a cost of $2 to $3 billion, but, as he predicted, they couldn't be sold and became worthless inventory. By early 2017, the power business was severely underperforming. After missing its 2016 target by over $500 million, tensions between Emmott and division head Steve Bowles reached new heights. Emmott blamed Bowles for GE's overall earnings miss, while Bowles seemed oblivious to the severity of the situation, even celebrating Power's performance. Despite mounting evidence that GE couldn't achieve its promised $2 per share earnings target for 2018, Emmott doubled down at the annual Electrical Products Group meeting in Florida. When pressed by analysts, he defensively insisted that $2 should be at the high end of the range for 2018 earnings. His performance deteriorated as he faced tough questions, eventually snapping at J.P. Morgan analyst Steve Tussa, swearing and making awkward jokes. One executive called it a fucking disaster, while a research analyst described it as flat as hell. Following this disastrous performance, Trion's Ed Garden called Emmott to say, "It's over. People have stopped listening. You have no credibility." Board lead director Jack Brennan contacted Emmott to discuss a timetable for stepping down, with the goal of naming a new CEO before the end of the second quarter. On June 12, 2017, GE announced that John Flannery would become CEO on August 1. The press release misleadingly claimed succession planning had been underway since 2011. At the analyst meeting, Flannery praised Emmott but acknowledged problems needing urgency and purpose, promising a comprehensive portfolio review by fall. While Immelt's departure caused GE stock to rise 4%, another problem was quietly emerging. CFO Jeff Bornstein had ordered an actuarial review of a long-forgotten insurance liability at GE's Kansas subsidiary that would become a ticking time bomb for the new CEO. Flannery's tenure would be short-lived. In January 2018, he announced a $9.5 billion pre-tax charge, $6.2 billion after tax, related to GE's insurance businesses, requiring $15 billion in capital contributions over 7 years. GE Capital suspended dividend payments to GE, and the company faced potential fines over WMC, the mortgage originator acquired during Immelt's tenure. In June 2018, Flannery announced the board's unanimous support for his vision. GE would separate its healthcare business through a 20% IPO, using proceeds to pay down debt, and spin off the remaining 80% to shareholders. Combined with the previously announced merger of GE's transportation business with Wabtec and the spin-off of Baker Hughes, GE would become focused primarily on aviation and power systems. Ironically, on the same day as the breakup announcement, GE was dropped from the Dow Jones Industrial Average after being a component since 1907. In July 2018, Flannery reported disastrous second-quarter earnings for the power division. Orders were down 26% year-over-year, with gas power systems equipment orders plummeting 78%. The power market had collapsed 50% in 2 years. GE sold 107 gas turbines in 2017, but expected only 50 in 2018. With operational challenges mounting and the stock price collapsing, GE's newly reconstituted board began asserting itself. Led by Ed Garden and Larry Culp, the board contemplated the once unthinkable decision of firing Flannery after just 15 months and replacing him with Culp, who would become the first outsider to lead the company in its 126-year history. On October 1, 2018, GE announced Flannery had resigned and reduced its 2018 earnings guidance, confirming a $23 billion impairment charge for the power business. Flannery left in shock, walking his dogs with his wife on Beacon Hill, trying to understand what had happened. On November 9, 2021, Larry Culp announced the end of General Electric after 129 years, breaking it into three separate companies: healthcare, to be spun off in 2023, energy, to be spun off in 2024 and renamed GE Vernova, and aviation, keeping the GE name with Culp as CEO. This decision essentially implemented Flannery's plan without acknowledging its origin. The announcement marked the final capitulation of what was once the world's most admired and valuable company. Steve Bowles, who nearly became CEO, identified three C's that went wrong at GE: capital allocation, corporate governance, and culture. Under both Welch and Immelt, too much capital went to GE Capital and unsuccessful M&A deals. Immelt overpaid for acquisitions, including Alstom, while selling NBCU cheaply. On governance, Bowles noted GE executives weren't trained in corporate governance at Crotonville, focusing instead on leadership. The board grew too large after GE Capital became a CFI, and the company accumulated excessive debt. Finally, GE's culture deteriorated from Jack's 4 E's, edge, execution, energy, energize, and 3 S, simplicity, speed, self-confidence, to Immelt's relentless push for growth without sufficient focus on profitability. One Wall Street analyst attributed GE's failure to the hubris of Harvard MBA training, arguing that the very skills that made Immelt a finalist to succeed Welch, creating persuasive presentations, flipping objections into sales points, ultimately led to success theater rather than actual performance. The analyst suggested that Immelt failed to recognize that energy is fundamentally a commodity business where technology doesn't improve product quality but merely increases supply, driving down global prices. Jim Grant of Grant's Interest Rate Observer diagnosed GE's fundamental problem as a loss of moral compass and the conceit of a company believing it could do no wrong. This hubris led GE to operate without backup lines of credit for billions in commercial paper borrowings and to ignore the inherent cyclicality of financial services businesses. As Grant told former United Technology CEO George David, GE would eventually have to burn their furniture to keep going. David replied, "There's a whole lot of furniture to burn." Eventually, Grant noted, there was a lot of furniture burned until the kindling caught fire, and then it all went up in smoke. Despite GE's dramatic fall, the company's technological legacy remains formidable. GE continues its tradition of innovation with over 35,000 active patents. Recent breakthroughs include the Affinity engines for supersonic jets, the GE9X, world's most powerful commercial jet engine, sustainable aviation fuel development, and work with Airbus on hydrogen-powered engines that could enable zero-emission flights by mid-2030s. At the Research Center in Niskayana, New York, scientists work on cutting-edge technologies like bioelectronic medicine, using non-invasive ultrasound to treat chronic diseases by stimulating neurons. The Additive Manufacturing Lab demonstrates how 3D printing revolutionizes manufacturing, consolidating 355 parts in the Catalyst aircraft engine into a single part, increasing power by 10% while reducing weight by 20%. Edison's quote in the lobby captures the spirit that drove GE's innovation. "I find out what the world needs, then I proceed to invent it."